All right, welcome everyone to tonight's Wireside Chat. I'm Paul Witcover. I'm the Dean of the Online MFA, as some of you may know. I'm joined tonight by Jason Morgan, who writes under the name J. Lloyd Morgan. He's a best-selling author, associate professor of English, and award-winning television director. He earned his MFA in creative writing in 2014 from National University. He also graduated from Brigham Young University with a degree in communications and a minor in English. He has lived all over the United States, but now resides in North Carolina with his wife, where they raised four children. Aside from writing, Morgan is an avid reader. He's also a huge fan of baseball and enjoys listening to music. Aside from his most recent novel, Going Down the Far Well, Morgan's other published novels include The Barrowan Chronicles, which is comprised of The Hidden Sun, The Waxing Moon, and The Zealous Star, Wall of Faith, Bring Down the Rain, Darker the Shadow, and The Mirror of the Soul, which was written in conjunction with musician Chris de Burgh. Morgan joined SNHU in September 2018. Last month, he was a recipient of the Outstanding Educator Award, given annually by SNHU to a select few instructors whose work is of the highest quality. But anyone who has had Jason for an instructor already knows just how outstanding an educator he is. I've wanted to have Jason as a guest on Wireside Chat, and I'm thrilled to finally have the chance. So, Jason, welcome.
Well, thank you so much. That was it was touching. I realized what, dang, I've done some stuff in my life.
Yes, you have.
Yeah. So thank you everyone for coming, and I hope that I don't bore you with my melodious voice here. We'll try to keep it interesting.
I think we have a lot to talk about, and I'd like to invite everyone or remind everyone that the chat is open. If you have questions for Jason about anything at all, just post them in there, and we'll surface them up and make sure that he has a chance to answer them. You know, if you've been to these chats before, they're very freewheeling. I don't come with a list of questions or anything like that. And I'm apt to just jump in wherever. And so here I am going to just jump in wherever. Something in your bio really interested me, which is that you wrote a novel in collaboration with a musician. So, first of all, how did something like that come about? And secondly, what is it like to collaborate with another artist, right? Here's somebody whose métier is music, and you're someone who's working with words. How did you manage to make your partnership work?
It was a bit of insanity is what actually it was. So a lot of people, I mean, some of the older folks are familiar with Chris de Burgh. He had a huge hit in America, called Lady in Red, in the 1980s. And so he is a national best-selling recording artist. He sold over like 30 million records throughout the world and stuff like this. And so he continues to put out music. And there was a song on his story. He actually has one of his albums called The Storyteller. And there's this, it's actually kind of like this 9-minute epic called The Mirror of the Soul. And I thought, wow, this is a great story. This would make a great book. And I thought, oh, why not? So let me reach out to his publishing company, his publishers. And I pitched an idea of, about writing a basic idea, and there's never expecting to hear back, and they respond, and they said, well, actually we're interested. Let me let's we'll run by your proposal to Chris and see what he thinks. I'm like, oh my goodness, okay. And the next thing I know, I get an email from Chris saying, hey, yeah, that sounds really interesting. What do and then we just started conversing back and forth. And the primary song is the main storyline. But I'm such a fan of his. He's got about 16 or 17 albums that I interwove a lot of his other songs into the story. And so the collaboration process was, staying true to the main story by augmenting it with different characters and different scenarios from his other stories. And it was putting like a giant jigsaw puzzle together. He let me have a lot of free rein. It was very supportive, and stuff like this. And so it was a really, it was a dream come true. Because I mean, it's like as a kid growing up, you're like, you see him on MTV, it's like, don't pay the ferryman. That was like one of the first videos I saw on MTV. I was like, And this is so I, you know, I loved his music. So to get a chance to work with someone that you admired was pretty neat. And he was actually extremely gracious and stuff like that. So yeah, it was a cool experience.
That is awesomely cool. And I guess one of the takeaways from that is like, if you have an idea, pitch it.
Oh yeah. Right?
I mean, because you could have very easily said to yourself, well, this would make a great book, but I know there's no chance that it's going to work out. Why waste my time pitching? But you didn't do that. You went ahead and made the pitch and it all worked out.
The answer is always no, unless you ask.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like, you know, those are the moments where the imposter syndrome kind of rears its head. Right. And you sort of think like, who am I to be, you know, addressing this, you know, huge best-selling musician.
Right. And then on his official Facebook post, I remember after it released, it sold all really well in Germany, of all places. But, you know, he promoted it. I'm like, wait, that's my book that I wrote that one of my idols, is promoting. And he said, actually, I really liked it. I'm like, well, I'm glad you liked it, you know, so. Anyway,
so I guess I should reach out to Mick Jagger now or something.
Yes, I mean, again, the answer is always no. So,
so tell us a little bit about your writing journey. Like, how did you get started? What kind of you've written books that are kind of all over the place in terms mm-hmm. of genre. Yeah. So, talk a little bit about that as well, if you don't mind.
Well, I was thinking about this question. I don't want to bore folks, but I should, in all reality, I shouldn't be a writer because I have dyslexia. And growing up as a kid, before technology, I used to drive my mom nuts because I used to always say, what if grass was made out of candy? Or, you know, whatever. I always had these what if questions, but I always had story ideas, but I couldn't spell for the life of me. And I couldn't put my words, my ideas into words. And so I actually became my first career was in television. I was a television director for a lot of years. And then technology kind of caught up, and with spell check and with all the different tools that we had, I was, I didn't spend half an hour trying to look up the word toward in the dictionary. You know, it's not under TW, by the way. and so once some of the technology came where I could kind of like get going on. So I didn't really write my first book until I was in my 40s. Where I really felt like I got to the point where I could do that. And so I actually, my first book I wrote for, so I have four daughters, and they were all 6 years apart. I mean, not 6 years apart. We had our first kid, and then 6 years we had our last kid. So they were all together.
Okay.
And so I wanted to write a book for them. And that was my first book, The Hidden Son. And my wife was like, this is actually pretty good. You should probably shop this around. I'm like, oh, no one's gonna want to, you know, do this. And then it gets published, and then there you go. And then, right. And as far as you know, I guess the term genre bending, it's like, I'm just kind of like, well, I mean, there's certain, I've read so much. That was growing up. That's what we did. It was, I mean, we just read. And so there's a lot of different genres that I enjoy. And so it's like, what do I want to write? Well, whatever's interesting to me at the time. So, but there are those, I mean, I've worked with a lot of students that are very much into certain genres, and good for them. Go for it. You know, and some don't want to be pigeonholed, and good for them, you know?
Right. I mean, I know a lot of times students may have broader interest than one particular genre, but they think to themselves, that's going to harm my career, right? Because if I sell my first book, that's what the publisher is going to expect me to continue on in. And if I pitch them with some completely different idea, you know, they're not going to go for it because I don't have a fan base in that, you know, in that genre. So what's your response to that?
Well, I mean, so, you know, the idea of, ooh, we really love that book. Write the same exact thing, but different, you know? And so it's kind of like, well, I've always been of the mindset that, you know, if I'm not interested in what I'm writing, it's not going to be interesting to read. And so, you know, actually I had a little, so I've done all sorts of different types of publishing. And I eventually broke away with my initial publisher because I didn't plan on writing a trilogy at first. The Hidden Sun just kind of lent its way to the Waxing Moon. And then I had an idea for the third book, and I pitched it, and they liked it. And they, you know, and so I started writing it. And then they came to me and said, okay, for this book, your first two books were 100,000 words long because it's kind of speculative fiction. For this third book, we need you to keep it to 75,000 words. And I was like, well, why? You know, I mean, the story that I have kind of planned out, I'm a little bit more of a pantser than I am a plotter, but the idea I had, I'm like, I don't know that I can do that in 75,000 words. Why? And they're like, oh, it's cheaper to print. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm like, huh? You know, and so that just was a as far as there's a question I'll answer in just a second. As far as, you know, the idea of, you know, like letting the publisher kind of dictate what I'm going to write, I wasn't real a big fan of that. That makes sense.
Absolutely.
So there's someone that have just asked a question about having started as a TV director, never going to consider my book into a show or movie. So to be clear, actually what I directed was newscasts and interview programs. I worked at a news station. I ended up leaving that field because I had four kids and I never saw them because I was on call 24/7. So yeah, so I don't, you know, that part of it is, you know, it's not really the entertainment side of things. So that's, you know,
right.
And I haven't done that in a while. So I don't know that I'd ever want to go back into that, that field.
What about TikTok? That's always waiting for you. Book talk.
Actually. So I do have a YouTube channel, and I'm not self promoting, but actually the funniest thing is I created a video because I work my main job is I'm a department head of humanities, arts and interdisciplinary studies, at a college, a university in Raleigh, North Carolina. And I was so tired of my students not doing MLA formatting. So I created a video to show how to do MLA formatting in 2019. And it ended up getting like 300,000 views. And so I updated it recently, like last year. And now it's up to like 200,000 views. And now it's I've got enough followers where it's monetized. So I'm like, okay,
wow. Well,
here's how you know. So I, you know, I'll put little videos out about writing or, you know, English or the craft. And so, actually I just got done. I'm in the process of finishing, teaching 604 right now, where we talk about promotion. I never really got into TikTok, but YouTube was kind of my thing. So,
right. Hey, if you don't mind, could you throw the URL of your YouTube channel into the chat? I'm sure people would love to see it.
I'll see if I can't pull it up. Why don't you ask me a question while I pull it up?
Okay, I will. And in fact, it's a question that fits in very well because, you know, you're an instructor who brings video to bear in your pedagogy. Like, you know, when you're giving students feedback, you'll talk to them. You'll record a video that kind of goes through, you know, the points that you want to make. Oftentimes, you'll have a video in your weekly announcements.
Mm-hmm.
Not every instructor does that. We like to give instructors, you know, a lot of freedom in whether they want to use videos or not. But just from your perspective, what is it about video format that attracts you as a means of engaging with your students and offering feedback?
There's the politically correct answer, and then there's the non-politically. The reality is the main reason I do it is, you know, even with the best intentions, if I write something, depending on, I understand, you know, the whole idea of an emotional filter. The fact that, you know, if they can see me, if they can hear my tone of voice, then I'm conveying a lot more information, even though I can try to write things out. And the non-politically correct answer is just a lot easier to, you know, I can put a lot of information in a 2-minute video as opposed to writing it out. And I do so much writing as it is. It's just a nice change of pace. And the feedback from the students that I've had has been very positive. And I understand that not all instructors are comfortable doing that. And that's fine. I've just never had an issue with it. So,
yeah. And it's true. I mean, a lot of your students will reach out to you. They reach out to me and they're very appreciative of the effort that you put into your videos. So thank you for that.
Sure. Yeah.
I guess I'm going to segue into one of the bigger things that we wanted to talk about tonight, which is theme, the idea of theme in fiction. This was a subject that you had mentioned that might be of interest to our students. So first of all, why did you think that this would be a topic that would be of interest to students?
Well, it's for a couple of reasons. One of my favorite classes that I teach at my other job is it's basically Introduction to Literature. I try to teach it more like a literature appreciation class, where I try to get the students, because a lot of my students are right out of high school, and the only books they've ever read are books they've had to read for school. And so I'm trying to get them to connect their lives to the written word. And it's like, look, regardless of what text it is, you can find something to connect with. And as we have sort of been working with, so I've been here, several years, and I've taught the capstone courses several times. I think, a lot of writers aren't really sure what theme is and how to incorporate that in writing. And I think there's a very good reason why that's an issue, because I'm kind of doing, some extra research for tonight. I could not find a unified definition of theme.
Yeah, that's true.
There's people that say it's this thing, and then there's people who say it's this other thing, and sometimes they conflict and contradict each other. Generally, for me, when I've been, what I was thinking as I was been working with my students who finish up the MFA program, as they finish their first draft at the end of 701, I'll ask them, I say, okay, well, what are the themes of your book? And a lot of the time they don't have an idea. They don't even consider it. And they have themes. They just may not recognize it. And I said, well, for me, I actually have a quote here from a fairly famous author, Terry Pratchett. The first draft is just you telling yourself the story. I'm a big believer of that. I really don't know what my story is until I'm done with my first draft. And then once I'm done with the first draft, I'm like, okay, now I can understand more what the story is about. And I can look at the thematic elements. And when I go to do revision, that helps guide me during the revision process.
You say you can look at the thematic elements, though, what are those elements that you're looking at?
Well, so the best definition of theme is it's an important idea that's woven throughout the story.
I want to distinguish the theme from a moral.
Like, right.
A theme is not the moral of the story, right? It's not the lesson that the story is trying to teach you.
No, in fact, I think that's a common misconception. It's like, because again, being older, when I was a kid watching cartoons, you'd watch a cartoon and then the last 2 minutes are like, so kids, the moral of this story is, whatever. The theme is, okay, again, another addition to this is the theme is like at least a big idea about our world with actually what happens in the text. And, that's where it gets a little muddy. It's like, okay, what are these big ideas? Are they universal or not? We'll get to that in just a second, because that's something I'd love to hear folks' insight on this. But it's like, okay, once I get to know my characters and once I get to know what the story is about, it's really what drives the character. What drives someone to do something? The character wants to do something and stuff gets in the way, the conflict, the obstacles and stuff like that. And as they grow and develop, what drives them to do different things? And often these challenges or these obstacles that they have to overcome have kind of a commonality. There's some sort of element of whatever. So, for example, my book, Bring Down the Rain, I realized when I finished writing it, it really had a lot of elements about dealing with what the concept of sacrifice is. And for a quick 30-second story, the name, I don't come up with the names of my books until I'm done writing them, because I want them to be relating to what the book is. Just out of curiosity, has anyone ever heard the term, not make it rain, right, but bring down the rain? Has anyone heard that phrase before? Just throwing that out there to anybody.
It kind of has a musical ring to it. Isn't there a song about
I'm sure there's all sorts of different things. Someone's mentioned it's a country song. Some people said no. Some people have said yes. Kind of just depends. So in the context of this, so growing up, I played baseball. That was my sport. And you know, for those who know anything, again, this is the, it has different meanings. So, but this is the meaning that I drove up from. Small little baseball lesson. If you're trying to get a runner home from third base and there's less than two outs, one way to get them home is that the batter can hit a deep fly ball and then the outfielder will catch it and the batter will get out. And then if the runner from third can make it home before the throw comes in, then they can score the run, because the object of the game is to score more runs. And sometimes the batter will have to sacrifice themselves. And so my coach would say, sometimes when he was, you know, when I'd go up to bat, he just wanted the run home. And he'd say, bring down the rain, mean hit the ball so high in the air that when it comes down, it brings down the rain with it.
Okay, cool.
And the main character of the story was a really good baseball player before he got into an injury, and that he wasn't going to be able to play anymore. So there's there's like the baseball part of it. So that's kind of the it's a term about sacrifice. And I'm like, okay, if the story has, you know, these thematic elements about sacrifice, when I go back in, what are some things that I can add that can really kind of enhance that? And this all gets back to why is the theme important in period, and why I don't want to bring it up, because I think all of us have read books or watched movies or TV shows, and we've walked away going, well, that was and there's times it's like, wow, that really resonated with me. And I think often it's when there's a really concentrated effort of having a unified theme. It doesn't necessarily have to bash people over the head with it. It's not like this really, you know, hard hitting, like, this is what I believe and you've got to do this. It really kind of opens up questions. You know, if you could think, you know, if I walk away from reading a book and I think about what happened and why, then I know that it's very satisfying. So I think that the idea of having, you know, kind of like, you know, theme as part of what we're trying to write makes it a stronger product and a stronger story. So
would you say that generally speaking, theme raises questions in a book rather than answering them?
Well, I would say that I think if it tends to, I think themes should, again, this is my personal opinion, kind of raise more questions. I think if they're trying to answer it, then it kind of seeps over more to the moral.
Right.
Thing. And there was a question in the chat that says,
yeah, I'm going to pull the question out of the chat now. Okay. Do you feel that theme drives characters, or do characters drive the theme? Which comes first, the metaphorical chicken or the egg?
Well, thank you for the question. And the answer is, it depends on who you are as a writer. again, for me, if we have the, you know, for lack of a term, spectrum of plotter and pantser, I'm here. I'm very much a pantser. The best ideas come to me while I'm in the act of writing. For me, that's the magic. That's the creative part. Yet I know, working with a lot of my students, they're very much more on the plotter side. So, you know, I think it depends on the way that people approach writing. For me, I discover the theme as I'm writing. For though there are others that have a theme in mind and they will build their story based on that. So which one comes first? I think it kind of depends on the way you approach writing.
Right. You're the author of your books, right? Every writer is the author of their book, except for ChatGPT. So you're writing this book, and you write the first draft of it, and you're reading over it and thinking about how you're going to revise it, and you start to notice the themes, as you said. But you put those themes in there.
Oh, right? Yeah.
They didn't just come out of nowhere. So how is it that you didn't recognize them until this particular point?
Well, and I think that's one of the questions that I ask in general, because when I have students study books or plays or whatever, in fact, I'll answer that in two different ways. So for the class that I'm teaching right now, we're studying a Raisin in the Sun. And there's, you know, there's a lot of thematic elements. There's the main one, that's kind of, you know, what you can do research on. But I, you know, the final paper is, what are the themes that the students take from it, right? And so they're valid as long as they can back it up with, you know, reasoning and textual evidence. And there's times when, you know, the stuff is there. And I've had people, you know, write, you know, what's the plural of analysis?
Analysis.
But that have, you know, done of some of my books, and they're like, oh, the thematic elements of this. I'm like, no, they're not. I mean, yes, they are. I mean, you clearly have made your point, and you're using textual evidence, and I'm like, I put it there, so I guess it must be a thing. So how much of it is it done on a subconscious level, and how much of it is a conscious level? So I think, you know, analysis is the plural. Thanks. All thank right. you. Thank you for that, Don. But I think, you know, for me, because of the way that I write, like I said, I just kind of write and ideas come to me while I'm writing. I think it's more subconscious. And then I go back in, and I'm like, huh, okay, this is what it's almost like I'm packing. It's like I'm packing to go somewhere, you know, on vacation. And then I open up my suitcase. I'm like, I don't remember putting that in there, but it's there. And I can't deny that it's there. And I'm the only one that puts stuff in my suitcase. So.
I mean, I actually write very much the same way that you do. I'm very much a pantser. I don't have a preordained plan. Certainly don't have any themes in mind when I set out to write a novel. But I do find that with experience has come the ability to maybe detect the theme a little bit earlier than after the first draft, or not detect the theme, but detect a possible theme, right?
Right.
So you're writing along and you're like, oh, here's an element that I could develop further. Here's something that I could keep in mind and sort of enhance and play with as I continue to pants my way through this novel. I have no idea what it's going to turn into, right, mind you. I don't know. I still don't know what I'm trying to say, if anything. But it's just something. It's an interesting correspondence, right? Or it rhymes in some way with other things that are happening in the book, right? So I'll just decide, well, I'm going to play with that for a while and see where it goes.
And I agree, because I, you know, as I tell my students, I often, you know, I really don't find my tone, my voice, and really understand the story until I get a few chapters in. And then I always go back and rewrite the first few chapters because I'm like, now that I know what the story is about. Because I sometimes will foreshadow things that I never do, or I'm like, man, I really should have foreshadowed that. So
yeah.
There was a something here. There are a lot of great quotes stuff here in the chat. So, Dean, would you mind reading the one from Amber?
Yeah. Okay. It says, maybe themes are also built on perspective and personal context, so non-primary themes may hit readers differently than the writer intended.
That is beautiful, okay? Because one of the challenges that, as I was doing, again, some just digging and research into theme before this meeting or this wire chat, was one of the definitions, it's a universal truth. And that kind of struck me interestingly. It gave me a reason to pause. I think, you know, so let me throw that out to folks in the chat. You know, what are people's thoughts about theme being defined as universal truths?
Feel free to throw your thoughts into the chat, everyone.
So again, the question is, you know, universal truths, or the universal, you know, concepts.
So here's a response from Michael, who says that's reader response theory. We always bring something to the reading, even if we read something at different times during your life. Mm-hmm. And that's also this is a somewhat slight segue, but it's extraordinarily interesting to me how encountering the same text at different points in your reading life will allow you a new perspective that will bring new themes to light. And in a way, that's the sign of a lasting and enduring work, I think. That a powerful artistic statement, because it's not just one thing forever.
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak for everyone else, but I mean, there are certain books that I will go back and read, like, you know, once a year, some of my favorites. And there'll be times I'll be like, wait a minute, when did the author put this in the book?
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, it's been there, but my life has changed, you know. So I think that, you know, the concept of I tend to give pause to anything generally towards things that are absolutes. And so for something to be universal, is, you know, cause I, you know, I'm not the same person I was 20 years ago. I'll probably, you know, and if I live, heaven forbid, you know, I mean, heaven forbid, you know, if I'm, you know, live 20 more years, I'll probably not be the same person then. You know, so it's, I think there's a lot of what people are saying is like, the perspective of what people read. I may intend something, and I will tell you, and I don't mean to ruffle any feathers here, but it drives me crazy when English teachers say, what did the author mean? And my response is, I don't know, because I'm not the author. You know, it's like, I'm not sure even the author knew what they meant.
Right. I personally don't believe that the author knows what they mean. I always feel like authors are the absolute worst people to ask about, like, you know, to explain a story or something that they wrote to you, because they're telling their truth, but that's not necessarily your truth from the story. I mean, as a writer, you've got it. You write the story, then you let it go. It doesn't belong to you anymore. It's not yours to interpret.
And that's, you know, that's the thing is. So actually, I want to comment something on Vanessa.
Yep.
I want to just share a little thing about the idea of once you kind of let something go, it's gone. You know, I think, gosh, you know, way back in the days of taking ethics in, you know, my college days, I think it was Aristotle or perhaps in Plato that talked about truth with a capital T and truth with a little t. Truth, you know, the truth with a capital T is like, it is what it is. And truth with a little t is kind of like our perception of what something is. And, you know, I again, personally speaking, you know, it's like my ideas, and as I get older and wiser, or at least get more experience, I'm like, well, what I thought before was a thing, maybe not, as I learn more. So, you know, there's that. And then actually in one of my books, it was in Bring Down the Rain, the main character, his name is Derek, he had to give a presentation on the power of the written word. And he related it to, because again, this is kind of with my, you know, experience in writing for television, is like, once you speak into a microphone, it becomes an electrical signal, and that signal will just keep going on. And usually the signal actually in the wire is very, very small. It'll then get to a transformer or something where it will then amplify it and interpret it different ways and whatever. So once you said it, it travels on until it has a reason to stop. But when it's received, it is then changed by whatever receives it. And so in that regard, you know, it's like, you know, especially, you know, you don't want to be that author. Well, I don't want to say that because that's an absolute. I've seen authors that, you know, they get on the, you know, Goodreads and it's like, that's not what I meant. What I meant was this, you know, how dare you say that? That's not what I said, you know, you can't do that. I mean, once the book is out there, it's out there.
Yeah.
You know.
No, never respond. No, don't respond to your reviewers on Amazon or Goodreads or right. Or anywhere else. That's always been my philosophy anyway.
Yeah, I agree. So, someone had mentioned Don. So I had an AP course in history that asked about this one story, and I took something totally different from it, and I was told I was just wrong.
Yeah.
So much for perspective.
I mean, history is somewhat different than fiction. I mean, you can certainly make the case that history too is a form of fiction, right? The winners are the ones who write the history, so to speak.
Right. Yeah.
But I do feel like there are certain facts in it's more defensible to say that there are certain facts in history than to say that there are certain facts in fiction.
Right.
I mean, I guess you could say it's a fact, that Charles Dickens wrote Great Expectations on such and such a day, or it has, you know, Pip is the name of a character in Great Expectations. Those are facts, but they don't really impact a theme in the story or how the story impacts you as a reader.
So there's I have so many thoughts going through my head, but we have so many great questions. There's another one here. Do I ever go back and reread old work? If so, do you feel your perspective on it changes after duration as time has passed? Yes, absolutely. I go back and reread. Just for the sake of, my first four books that were published were before I earned my MFA. And I had no idea what I was doing. And it wasn't until I earned my MFA that I'm like, oh. And I think one reason why I was able to actually write, you know, somewhat coherently is because I had read so much. And so I knew how stories were, because seriously, by just being so exposed,
osmosis, you had to absorb those structures and so on.
And so, you know, when people tell me it's like, oh, you're a writer, I'm a writer. I'm working on the book. I'm like, cool. What are you currently reading? And they're like, oh, I don't like to read. I'm like, oh dear. but I think it's when I go back and read my first book, there's such an innocence to it. And so it's just kind of sweet. I don't know if that makes any sense. It's almost like, you know, growing up when things were magical and there were, you know, fairies and, you know, the tooth fairy or something like this. And now as I get older, spoiler alert, you know, I'm not so sure about that anymore. You know, I know a lot more of how to write and construct stories. And I feel like I'm a much better writer now. At the same time, I'm like, how much do I let that knowledge kind of just fall on the wayside and let the story come forth?
Right.
So,
that's a great point. I mean, I'm just thinking back myself to like some of my early novels. And there is something there that I can't really do anymore. And I think it's naivety, you know, it's like the idea that something spontaneous stuff still happens to me because I'm a pantser, as I said. But
right.
I don't think, you know what it is? I don't think that I can be drunk on my own words in the same way that I could when I was just starting out. Because now that critical part is always there going like, oh, you're going to have to cut that. You know, that's one of those darlings you're going to have to kill. It doesn't belong here. Whereas before, I wouldn't have known that. And I left some stuff in that now I would take out, but that made the book better.
Well, and so actually, so, you know, to that point, again, shameless promotion over my corner. So the second edition of Bring Down the Rain just came out, and my publisher wanted to do an audiobook with it this time around. And so I had a chance to kind of go back through, and I just, it was a solid book. It had legs, so it just kind of kept going. But I went in and through, I went back and had a, you know, I was able to kind of fix some, not really fix anything, I say enhance some things based on what I had learned. And I thought it made for a stronger story. But I also have the saying, stories are never done, they're only due, you know? right. So there is, you know, and I can't speak for everybody else, you know, for those of you who have finished, you know, I'll ask you, Dean. I'm sorry, I feel weird calling you Paul. It's just
whatever. Yeah. The first time you said that, I was like, who the hell is that?
But yeah, not. I know. It's just it's a thing. But it's like, I don't know about you, but when I'm done finally with the final draft that's going to go off into the world, I am so sick of that book. And it's
characters.
I am just like, I just can't, you know. Someone mentioned in the chat, it's like, sometimes they need a good year away from it to really be able to go back and look at it. I think, you know, having that space and time away from it is very helpful to be able to get some perspective. And, you know, you also talking, you know, kind of referring back to reading work that I've done before, it's interesting because I can be like, as I'm reading the book, I'm like, I know exactly what was going on in my life at that point in time, you know, because what's ever happening with my life seems to find its way as I'm, you know, because I think it's, you know, writing is very cathartic. And so, you know, it's a great form of therapy, you know, granted it could be, you know, in any kind of genre. It doesn't have to be a, you know, a self-help book or anything like that. So,
right. It doesn't have to be a thinly disguised memoir or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
What you said were saying earlier reminded me of a quote. I can't remember who said this, but it's something to the effect of novels are never finished. They're only abandoned.
Actually, I said that. No, I didn't. But that's about right. I mean, because or the person that will say, oh, I'm working on my book. And they're like, oh, how far have you gotten into it? Just about got my first chapter perfect.
Right.
I'm like, well, guess what? You write the rest of the story.
Yeah, you're never going to get to your last chapter if you're.
Yeah. So.
But you know what? That's something a lot of our students face, right? They feel like they can't move on until something is perfect, or maybe they don't even put it to themselves that way. But there's almost a kind of like iterative obsession that they just have to go over the same stuff. I did that for many, many years. It was a hard habit to break. I don't know if that was anything that you experienced in your own work.
I would say, I mean, it's something I learned over time. Where, you know, my first book took me a long time to write because I was writing it piecemeal here or there. And now, I mean, I write during the Christmas break and I write during the summer because I'm so busy with my other stuff, because I want to have my head be fully clear when I'm focusing on it. And it's gotten to the point where I kind of just have to let it go, if that makes any sense. I don't, it's hard to say. It's I realize that revision is part of the writing process, and I realize that, you know, sometimes it's just I have to get the ideas down. And I mean, some of the best ideas I've come up with never make it into a book. They may end up in another book.
Right.
You know,
right.
Don't overthrow. If you kill one of your darlings, don't kill it. Just, you know, wrap it up in a nice thing and put it on a shelf somewhere in case you need it later on. You know, I think that's one of the approaches to take. And actually to something you had mentioned earlier about this is a discussion that we have, especially with the students that really matriculate through the program, is the idea of, because we're critical readers. And this job, I love this job. I love teaching these courses. It has, there's an occupational hazard to it, though. I have a dickens of a time, excuse the pun, sitting down and just picking up a book and reading it for enjoyment.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I feel like part of me has lost that ability. I'm trying to turn off that analytical part of my brain, but it's really a challenge. I don't know if you've run into that or not. Or...
Oh, I absolutely run into that. It's become increasingly difficult to have that sort of reading experience. And in fact, one of my little theories is that, you know, writers are people who try to create for others the experience that they once had in reading, you know, that joyous feeling of losing oneself in a good book. That gets harder and harder as you become more aware of the little tricks and tropes and everything that's going on, and more aware of on a sentence level, even, of what the writer is doing. It's hard to relax and forget about all that.
So someone's asked, wait, that doesn't get any better. The answer is, it depends on who you are as an individual. I mean, it's, again, everyone's wired differently. And the way that they go, it's just, I mean, right now in my life, I spend so much time working with students and working on their concepts that it's just, that's really kind of the way that I think. You know, perhaps, you know, once I retire, you know, and I'm focusing just
retire. On what's that?
That's when I die. You know?
Yeah, writers like books are never finished, merely abandoned.
Right, that's right. You know, there's so many great comments here.
Questions are coming like wildfire. There's one up here I wanted to give to you.
Sure.
See if I can find it here. Yeah, here it is. This from Bethany says, I find it hard to get through the middle because I question if I've revealed too much too early. And I feel like the question of like, what do you need to reveal and when is an important one for writers, obviously, because it affects everything from the plot to the pace and, mm-hmm. you know, everything in between. So what is your reaction to that question about revealing too much too early?
I think they call it the mushy middle for a reason. Right. I know that in working with folks, they have a really good premise, a really good setup, and they have an idea of where they're going to end up. And then sometimes they're like, okay, I don't want to give away too much too soon. And again, I think that goes back to the whole idea of where I tell myself, you know, revision is part of the writing process. I may reveal stuff in my first draft fairly early on in the middle. And then during the revision process, recognize, okay, there's an opportunity here for some more character development that I can push this off, or maybe, you know, foreshadow it a little bit more and really kind of help build the suspense while keeping the pacing going. So I would say if the idea comes to you, get it down, write it down with the understanding that, you know, have I revealed this too early? Maybe, but I can always, you know, at least I have something to work with later on. Yeah. Because there have been times when I've come up with this idea. I'm like, oh, it's too early for that. And then later on, when I'm ready for it, I'm like, oh, dang, what was that idea?
Yeah.
Right. You know, I'm like, dang it. So,
you know what else I found, like, and I'm not, Bethany, I'm not saying that this is your situation, but I've noticed this before, and sometimes in my work, sometimes in other writers' work. If you have something that you want to save until later, a big reveal, it closes things off. Mm. It takes away your freedom in everything in the narrative up until that big reveal. You're locked in because everything is going up to that big reveal. And I find that that gets associated sometimes with writer's block, because you're thinking like, well, what do I do now? How do I get from here to there when I need the big reveal here? And a lot of times the answer is you don't need the big reveal there. Give it away earlier.
Yeah.
And that will free everything up, and you'll be surprised in the way your story may go. Something really surprising. Something that surprises you as well as the reader, right? Because if you already know what the surprise is, it's I feel like that foreknowledge communicates itself in some way to the reader.
And so there's just kind of a couple of quick thoughts just based on what you said and what some folks are asking is the whole idea of writer's block, because as I've worked with students in this program, in the MFA program at Southern New Hampshire, we have folks do an outline. And I think it's very important for students to experience that at least once in their life. And how they're going to be able to do outlines and how they're going to incorporate outlines in the future is really kind of up to them, but at least to have the experience. I have had students that feel like, I came up with this great idea, but it's not my outline. What am I supposed to do, Professor Morgan? I'm like, change your outline. You know, there's that thing. And the concept of, writer's block is like, so some people have asked me how do you get past that? And again, this is a trick that works for me. It may not work for everybody else. Is I start monologuing, or I'll start writing something. It's like, okay, so I'm in the thing. I'm like, so the first thing I write when I have writer's block is, it was a dark and stormy night. Jason was sitting at his computer trying to figure out what the next thing he was going to happen. His character, so-and-so, was faced with such and such a challenge, and whatever. And as I just start writing, while I'm in the act of writing, all of a sudden the stuff in my head starts kind of clearing up. If I just sit there and stare at the blank screen, nothing's going to happen. But I find that if I start writing something, anything, the juices start flowing, for lack of a better phrase. So
that's interesting. That's like almost like a kind of muscle memory. You're like giving the engine a jump start.
Exactly. Because I mean, when I have like my students, if I'm teaching a face-to-face class and I give them a writing prompt and they're just like staring at me, I'm like, okay, seriously, just write anything. Okay, well, the professor told me I had to write this particular thing and I didn't know what to write about. So I started writing it, and all of a sudden then they're off to the races.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I'm going to circle back to a question here that itself circles back to what you might say is the theme of our Wireside Chat tonight, which is theme.
Yes.
And this is from Amy, who asks, how do you incorporate themes in overcoming writer's block? Do you use it as a strategy to get back on track with where the story is heading?
That is an excellent question. And I think it depends on where you are in the book and where you are in the process. I think because there have been times when I'm not quite sure where I'm going to go next with the story, and I have a few different ideas, and I'll go back and reread everything that I've done up to be, you know, whatever. And I'll be like, okay, even though I haven't finished my first draft, at least I can see like the trends, and I can kind of see, you know, because I, again, one of my sayings is, if people don't care about the characters, they're not going to care what happens to them. And caring is not the same thing as liking, you know, and as you see these characters develop and grow and stuff like this, you know, a lot of theme is derived particularly from what the characters do. How have they changed over time? You know, what's different at the end of the story from when it's the beginning of the story, you know? And so I'm like, how have they changed? And, you know, in our, for the capstone courses, there's the book, Story Genius, that we get to use. And, you know, the concept of, you know, stories aren't this happened and then this happened and this happened and this happened. It's like this happened, and because this happened, then this happened, or this happened, and despite this happening, then this happened. And so I kind of keep that in mind. So as far as them, you know, theme driving that, I honestly kind of think theme for me is much more kind of like the background foundation of what I'm working on. It's almost, or I also call it the sandbox. As long as I stay inside the sandbox, I'm okay. I can do whatever I want to in the sandbox. And I think that sandbox is often theme. It's often, you know, staying within my genre, staying within my tropes and stuff like that. But I love playing inside the sandbox and coming up with all sorts of different things.
Right. It's helpful to have some sort of binding structure, a framework within which you can work and be as creative as you like. I'm going to. Do you have any question in there that's grabbing your eye, Jason?
Well, just concepts about dyslexia, and actually, I don't know, doesn't have a mind's eye. Oh, yeah, my wife and I were talking about this the other day. She's like, close your eyes, and you know, and then she describes something. Can you see this? I'm like, well, yeah. And she's like, I can't, and I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah, I can't either. I do not have a mind's eye.
Yeah, and I don't know that it's, I mean, because again, every writer has a different approach. And, you know, just to say, you know, this is what works for me isn't necessarily going to work for somebody else. You know, as far as, you know, as far as dyslexia goes, for me, it was just, you know, to this day, the best thing that ever happened was spell check, because it, the little red line, and by sheer repetition, I would just eventually learn, oh, this is the thing. I love, you know, actually, I used to joke. I'm like, you know, you have to be, you know, as a creative person, you're not very creative if you've spelled the same word the same time every single way, you know? So,
Funny that you mentioned dyslexia, though, and a lot of people have been chiming in the chat saying that they too have dyslexia. And I, you know, I've been an editor at a major publisher. I'm involved with a lot of writing communities, and I teach, and, you know, and I just know a lot of writers, basically, is what I'm getting at. And a lot of them are dyslexic. I mean, it's extraordinary how many are. And I do feel like in some way it's connected to creativity.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I absolutely believe that. I definitely, you know, one of the reasons why I've been, this is going to sound kind of a little conceited, but I've been successful in my different careers is because I don't approach things the same way as other folks. And there's a, you know, there's been studies where, you know, corporations and stuff like this really are looking for creative thinkers. And, you know, so, I mean, when people ask me, is it, oh gosh, MFA, that's a fluff degree. MFA in creative writing, what are you going to do with that? A lot.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
I mean, it opened so many doors for me on so many different levels. And, you know, people who appreciate the skill sets to come with that, you know, yes, I continue to write and whatever, but in my, you know, current job as being a department head, you know, they lean on me a lot to come up with different takes on how to approach something. And I think that, again, not saying if you don't have dyslexia, you can't write, but I think that there is a connection between the creative spark and that, because our brains are just wired differently.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like, there are ways to adapt to all of this stuff, that whether it's dyslexia or aphantasia, you can kind of train yourself to work with these conditions. I don't think they have to be debilitating at all for a writer or a creative person.
No, and I think it's not that dissimilar from just a little, not trying to overshare here. So a couple of years ago, I had to have a surgery on my ankle, and they had to disconnect my Achilles tendon. And
oh my God.
Clean up some bone spurs. And then a day and a half later, it was the middle of the night, the tendon popped off. and I had to go back in, and they stuck it in there with a gigantic anchor, and then I had to go through all sorts of physical therapy. And when I got done, the doctor says, okay, no running, no jumping, no long walks. And I said, okay, for how long? He said, oh, for the rest of your life.
Oh my God.
And I'm like, huh? I said, can I mow my lawn? He's like, you could probably mow your lawn, And I'm like, okay. But you find ways to deal with life when you have these things. I mean, so there's, everyone has these things. And I also want to just, seems like a non sequitur, but just put a plug in for an MFA degree for those of who are listening and who want to go into education. Some folks may not realize this, but in education, and Paul, you may have a different way of understanding this, but this is my understanding, that a lot of the major colleges, there's different like ranks in academia. They're almost like military ranks. And it's like you have lecturer, instructor, assistant professor, associate professor, and then full professor. And an MFA degree is considered a terminal degree, which means that's actually well thought of. And
yeah, it doesn't mean it's going to kill you.
No, I mean, and actually when someone first asked me, it's like, what's your terminal degree? And I'm like, I don't have one. I'm still alive. And then I realized, oh, wait, an MFA is a terminal degree. But that, for a lot of schools, I mean, when you have an MFA, a terminal degree, you actually could enter in right at assistant professor. Again, I was just recently promoted to associate professor, where that's where I had to be, 8 years at least as an assistant professor, and you had to do a lot of things to become an associate professor. And then I don't think I'll ever make full professor, because that's a big deal. But so for those of you who want to actually do, writing at a, and teach writing, your MFA also opens a lot of doors in that regard too. So
yeah, absolutely does. And I recommend it. I mean, I think, if you can afford it, we don't want anybody to go broke pursuing their MFA, but I think it can be a real help in your career as a writer. It's a shortcut.
So someone says, I hope I didn't make a mistake in picking the MA. The answer is no, you did not make a mistake. Any education is an investment in yourself. Right.
Yeah.
So I had a lot of professors that answered to me that have MAs, and it's not like they're frowned upon.
Right. I don't have an MFA. I have an MA. I have an MA in English and creative writing.
Yeah.
That's what qualified me to teach to be the dean of the MFA program. No, it's weird, but MA is perfectly fine. It's just not a terminal degree. That's the only difference. People that get MAs typically go on, if they go on, they'll get a PhD.
Right.
Whereas an MFA, some people will go on and get a PhD. They offer PhDs in creative writing now, strangely enough. That is not considered to be the terminal degree in the field. The terminal degree is still considered to be the MFA.
And I think, without getting into too much in the weeds, I think the way it was explained to me is the MFA is you're actually demonstrating that you can do the thing.
Yeah.
The PhD is more like the theory.
The theory behind it. That's
right?
Absolutely correct.
You know, and so, that's why that's why there's a distinction. So.
Yeah. Well, folks, we've come to the end of our broadcast day here. It's 9:00. Thank you so much. Jason, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a real pleasure. I want to wish everyone a great Valentine's Day if you celebrate, and we'll have another great guest next month for the next edition of Wireside Chat. I hope some of you in the MFA program will be attending MFA WIP tomorrow. I'm really looking forward to that. And later this month, we have our instructor spotlight word for word event where we're focusing on poetry. And we have an instructor from the MA program and an instructor from the MFA program who will read their poems, talk about poetry, talk about its relationship to fiction, and all kinds of cool stuff like that.